Streets were mellow with first twilight. Doors were opening, and from building after building, white-dressed girls and blue-suited boys were coming, families following, as they led the way up Vandalia and walked catty-corner over to Bisher, and then down Bisher to 17th and over the bridge, catching and calling to friends along the way. Their movements were stiff and self-conscious, and their voices were artificial as they greeted one another and introduced the mothers and fathers behind them, dressed soberly as suicides for the occasion. Old Lady Ebinger, who had the fish market and was known by everyone, passed unrecognized without her blood-stained apron, and neither old nor sour walking beside her tall blonde son. Margaret had gone ahead to arrange something at the school, she said. Janice and Abel followed the others down the streets and watched the white girls glimmering along. Sometimes people nodded to them and they nodded back and smiled. The light was almost gone. Nobody asked them anything or bothered them with words, but they were greeted as belonging to the neighborhood and part of the proud evening. Soon the lips of the other greeters and answerers of greetings were no longer to be seen, and Abel and Janice walked on in the warm, purpling light in a joy so keen that it was almost painful. The street lights came on suddenly as they crossed Bisher, and without plan they turned and smiled at each other and took hands. At so proud an hour to be moving toward the same place and in the same rhythm as all these others, and to be known and greeted as a sharer in this event was a moment they had not foreseen. Abel spelled into Janice's hand, a word which she did not understand, but he didn't repeat it. The silence was better. They crossed the bridge below, which ran no water, but a dozen braiding and unbraiding sets of railroad tracks, and the dark shapes of warehouses and loading platforms of the railhead. Ahead of them was the high school, all lit and wide at the doors in welcome. For a moment, only a moment, they hung back, not wanting to leave the darkness and their sharing for the old, familiar enemy world of the hearing, in which they were strangers. The graduates had made their procession, looking young and beautiful. The speeches had been made in hearing's endless love for talk-talk. Prizes had been given and accepted, to Margaret honors 2 times. Although for what things they were unable to understand. It was enough that with only 3 or 4 others, she rose to be applauded by everyone. At last, the graduates were released to their families to return, now through the nighttime streets to kitchens where cake and wine waited on the sideboards, and tables were covered with cloths as for a wedding. Margaret met her parents in the hall outside the auditorium. As she came through the crowding relatives and flushed graduates, she saw they were standing together, very tall and proud in a far corner waiting for her. When she was close, they motioned her closer where they could talk without being seen. Abel was grinning. "See?" he said. He had some kind of machine attached to him. There was a twisted black cord running from behind his ear and going into his collar. In his ear there was a large, smooth, black bulb, like a box for a typewriter ribbon. "What is that?"
"I got it for your present. It is the present I told you about."
"What is it for?"
"It is electrical. It is a hearing machine."
"Then you hear? You can hear?"
His smile faded and his hands faltered for a moment.
"I had to shut it off. Terrible sounds. Sound makes a bad, bad pain in all the face and inside my head. When I cough or sneeze, I weep because of pain. It is like the sun breaking apart in my head. I have to turn it off."
"Then you can't hear with it."
"It is not for deafs. It is for hearing, like I told you. It is for you, this, like I told you before. It makes me to hearing, to you and your friends. I will not look so deaf."
13. A year in the business world, and Margaret could hardly remember what daydreams she and the girls in shorthand class had hatched and nurtured over their system books. In the year's time, she had worked in a small office on Perrer Street and in a big hive on Miller Avenue. There had been temporary filing and typing jobs in many places where the workload was seasonal, and where notices from closures, invitations, sales promotions deficits, and inventories ripened each in its own summer like fruit. For a week or two, there would be a harvesting, and then the offices would fall still and the reapers would move on. She was always thanked and always praised.
"We like your work. We hire our permanent people in the fall."
Then they said it was after Christmas that the work would pick up. Then spring. "The permanent jobs come in the spring." By spring, the want ads began to shrink again. She always left her name at the good jobs, giving Mr. Petrakis's number, and when she came home, she always stopped and checked with him before going upstairs. Sometimes there would be a call, but she stopped mostly because she liked talking to Mr. Petrakis. He was the only person who could tell how she was feeling by her face and manner. If the work was dull or the people unpleasant, he would shake his head and say, "Ah, look how they make you tired." Some of the offices were like small forests, alive with predators, and these baffled and exhausted her. Only he knew when she was working in such a place, and he would make a clumsy, comforting joke about it.
"If this bunch calls you afterwards, I'd tell them nothing doing. I am her secretary, and she ain't working for no bums."
"But she's the best bookkeeper we ever had," she would say.
"So she got a little job now, typing up letters for the president of the USA, and when she gets through with that, she'll let you know. But don't start hoping, because you are on the end of the list."
It pleased her that he knew the places and remembered each change, and was sorry with her when one of the good ones was over and it was time to look again. When she said goodnight and went into the narrow vestibule and up the stairs, she always felt better than she had before. She would help Janice get supper and do the dishes afterward, although there was seldom much to do. Janice took fierce pride in her own routine of work. Sometimes Margaret took in a movie with some school friends who were working or looking for work, and sometimes there was an engagement party or a wedding for one of the girls from school. But usually she would finish in the kitchen and then sit down to her radio and listen while she mended or rolled up her hair. Mr. Petrakis had given her the radio. It was an old set. The tone was scratchy and the mahogany veneer on the cabinet was cracked and had peeled out from under the rim where he had tried to glue it. He had given it to her on the night of her graduation when she had come home too disappointed to go or to explain about going to the graduation party. Abel had worn that hearing aid twice since graduation night, both times without the batteries. Sometimes when she looked at the bulky thing squatting on its little table, she remembered that first look at her father with his machine. She had been too angry and disappointed to do anything but stand there. Later, when they came back home together, Mr. Petrakis had been standing in his doorway holding something bulky that he had wrapped in an old blanket. They smiled at him and began to walk by.
"Hey,"
he said, and stepped out in front of them. There was an apologetic smile wavering on his face. He thrust the thing at Margaret and said,
"You're a good girl."
It looked like a dead dog wrapped up in the blanket that way.
"Congratulations."
She took it and felt sides and corners under the blanket, while Janice and Abel stood by smiling and nodding and waiting for meaning. She said thank you and went upstairs. In the morning, she put a letter under his door to thank him, and she made note of all the fixing he must have done on it to get it into such good condition. She tried to be grateful. She tried to want nothing better. Rarely did the Lone Ranger ride without her, or the creaking door open. She broke into 1,000 deserted farmhouses with the G-Men and sat with the Green Hornet as he squealed on thrilling rims around the desperate corners of the night. There had been nothing in her education by the soap operas to match the excitement of the nighttime programs, which she had never heard before. She listened to every mystery and adventure program, drama and comedy. She didn't like the famous comedians. Their wit seemed to elude her. Words meant did not mean, and the laughter of the audience came so fast that it made her feel ashamed to be caught unready, still sorting among the words. She liked the dramas best. Clear, simple dramas where people could make choices that they understood. She never read books, but would sit rapt and half-smiling, uplifted, despairing, and terrified
as the heroes and heroines died or married in voices of unusual beauty. It took her a long time to realize that Janice and Abel were jealous of the radio. They treated the set with casual carelessness, and Margaret was always replacing the plug or mending the cord after finding it wrenched from the socket during Janice's cleaning. Abel piled packages against it until it was pushed to the edge of the little table, and Margaret sometimes saw them looking at it as though they were trying to make it fall by an act of will. Sometimes they made jokes about her as she sat listening, leaning forward, her head tilted toward the silence from which silence came. Her sudden smiling, sudden weeping, tension and release of tension for nothing and no one.
"Look at the Margaret show," Abel would say.
Then, without sign, using only his expressive face, he would proceed to suffer a dozen changes of emotion. Once he enacted a savage murder, killing as joyfully as he died both villain and victim. Once he went mad and took to drink and joined the vaudeville. Margaret knew he was ridiculing her world, the stories and plays of which he had never been told. But she couldn't take her eyes from him. He was her father, yet he could be young and old in a minute. His face and body could perform acts of separation from his true self that were almost fearsome. All in the service of his game. Although it was ridicule and sad because Abel was jealous. And although the ridicule was poignant because he was lonely, the unplotted and outlandish imitations had flashes of breathtaking reality. Sometimes Margaret found herself waiting for his jealousies to burst into these inventions, and she would watch intently, above a smile or a grimace meant to mask her interest. Abel himself seemed to enjoy his game. He lost husband, father, printer, even death. He was none of those things when he played, but was reborn into a life undeath, unhearing. He liked being a policeman with a dead robber at his feet. Then he saw the robber. He saw the money in the robber's hand. He would not take the money. He would not take all of it. But maybe just one bill, just one that could be lost in the spaces between crime and justice. And his policeman face showed these things, and his policeman body showed them in the way it bent to pick up that single bill. Margaret always marveled at this sudden melting of faces and bodies between policeman and robber, victor and victim. Every time he played the game against her, he used another life. Margaret laughed and pretended to wave him away, but the laughter was a laughter of wonder, and she would go back to the radio more slowly and listen with a grave face. Margaret had never thought of her parents as being perceptive. They mistook the motives of other people, hearing and deaf, and they always credited everyone with the worst of motives. They kept grievances for years like family pets and filled themselves with gossip. Now she saw how closely Abel could watch, and with what accuracy he recorded the momentary hesitation of a hand or the turning of a head, things that spoke apart from language, and sometimes made liars of the words that were spoken with them. The radio made Abel sad. Janice hated it, and Abel's playing made things no better. When they were alone, she mocked him with her own cruel skill, saying he was afraid to stop Margaret from doing anything she wanted to do. "When she is here, she is not with us. She's sitting with her ear against that mouth, listening, listening all the time."
"They like to listen. It's like a movie to them."
"What does she listen to that is so important night after night? All that makes her tired, makes her old. Too much knowing makes people troubled in their mind. Look at them all, how impatient they are, how smart at hurting people. She is getting like them more and more." Abel, driven against his own wishes to defend, began his usual defense, but Janice waved his hands away. Why didn't Margaret go out with them anymore to the social hours at church? She didn't make friends with any of the sons or daughters of the people there. She didn't want to go shopping. She didn't have time to go to the clinic or the dentist or the bank man or the plumber or the salesgirl or the tax man. She only had time to keep secrets with the wooden mouth. Abel looked at her and then shrugged. There was no way to change things. Now the debt was paid, paid at last and over, and they had money and freedom at last to spend and save and share and enjoy,
after 20 years. And now it was too late. The hunger, the wanting, the joy in which Janice had once run into the world were gone. The piecework had finished it. The piecework had taught her that every moment away from the machine was a moment that made no money. Now, when the piecework was gone, she measured her life by 1,000 other tiny miser's measures. Now that the growing time was over, it was too late to give Margaret sunlight through shade trees as a memory. Now that the debt was paid, it seemed that no one was left alive. Abel saw Bradley in his mind. He had not thought of Bradley for many years except to push the thought away when any small bit of it appeared. Who is alive anymore? Then he thought simply, I am alive. Janice. He seldom used her name, even in abbreviation. It surprised her in the middle of her argument and made her stop with a stunned look on her face. I want to buy a house. On a street with trees. With a place in back. Green. With a tree. She looked at him for a long time without blinking or breathing. All her time had stopped because of shock. Then it broke in violent, soundless rage. Words flew out, stuttered, her fingers unable to follow her mind. Gestures were mixed with words, her hands as twisted as her face, her lips framing formless things. Abel, with one simply made, stop, turned and walked away. She seized the bedside lamp and raised it to throw to break against the wall, but the piecework had given its punishment too well. The lamp had been bought with money, and so it had a value. To break it would be to break the time it cost, the work, the money, the reality. It was like breaking a part of her own body. She put the lamp back and lay down and beat the bed and kicked at the wall until she could weep. The two of them waged bitter war from that time on, and Margaret wandered vaguely through the skirmish mornings and the battle nights. Sometimes her mind seethed with the silent wrangles, fingers in ambush, bruised arms, revenges. Both of them tried for her allegiance, and failing, seized her as hostage to the other. Their quarrel was about a house, she knew. She wanted a house, but wanted it too much to let herself think about it. At work, she tried to clear the struggle from her mind. It was one of the nicer jobs, and looked as though it might last for once. She had started as a temporary typist, but when the partners learned about her bookkeeping, they found some extra work for her to do. And when the regular secretary was out, she took over the desk and did some of the simpler billing as well. Margaret worked hardest when she was worried or unhappy. Bustling and business took her mind off other things. So the battles that Janice and Abel inflicted on each other were causing the filing system at Patman and Ruliger to be overhauled, while the secretary was home with what Margaret suspected was morning sickness. One day a man came in to see Mr. Ruliger, and when he gave his name, Margaret looked up at him a little surprised. He said,
Is something wrong?
No, she said. I'm sorry. Mr. Ruliger will be with you in a moment. She had not wanted to tell him that she had taken some of his calls, and that from his voice on the telephone she had thought him a much older man. He sat down to wait, and she went back to the files, which were in a small room off the office. The door was open, and occasionally she glanced at him as he waited. What drew her attention was his stillness. Most people waiting, no matter where or for whom, made waiting as much an action as walking. They fidgeted, picked their nails, took magazines up and did not read them, looking up every 2 or 3 minutes to the door by which they would be delivered from their waiting. This man was reading a book he had brought with him, and he seemed completely interested in it. He didn't pace the room with his eyes and wasn't caught off poise when Mr. Ruliger came out to greet him. When Margaret went back to the desk, she noticed a valise set carefully in the corner, near where he had been sitting. It was one of the cardboard kind, the cheapest that the Five and Dime had, and very new. When the man came out, he asked if he could leave it and come back for it later, at around 5. He was leaving for the army, he explained. His goodbyes had been said, and the winding up of the rest of his affairs had taken less time than he thought. She smiled and said,
Certainly.
He was back at 5:02, and then he asked her if she would have a cup of coffee with him. He asked simply, seriously, without affectation, and she agreed. Her directness seemed to surprise and please him. When they were drinking their coffee in one of the small, pleasant restaurants on Lamar, she began to have the feeling that he wanted to ask her something else, but couldn't. He was not a talkative man. His gestures were made very small and with great subtlety. They seldom went outward from his body, which was also compact, his arms and legs kept close. She had the feeling that even his tightly curled black hair hugged his head closely, out of a kind of neat, objective reserve. What he wanted was being said by his hand, or by one finger of it that moved up and down on the outside of the cup as he spoke about going away. The gesture was not like him, not like the way his hand seemed to speak. She saw then that he was afraid and could not admit it, that he wanted some kind of comfort. Then it was hard not to smile. To cover the reason for it, she asked him if he would like her to see him off, just to have someone who would go down to the bus terminal with him. His eyes widened and he smiled. He was not conscious of his finger moving on the cup, nor of its stopping. He was busy explaining to her why there was no one else. She said she understood. So they went to the bus terminal where they waited again. He asked her for her address and copied it neatly in a small book. When the bus began to load, they got up and shook hands, and she stayed until it left, waving him out of sight. She knew she would probably never hear from him again, but it had been a relief to take a rest from the argument at home. Miraculously, when she did get home, she found that the fight was over. Janice was sitting defiantly at the table among the dirty dishes, Abel smoking in cool triumph by the window. When Margaret came in, Janice motioned to the stove where a plate was being kept warm. The food was too spicy and oversalted. They must still have been arguing while Janice cooked. Margaret could see her stirring with short, hard strokes, signing back, then shaking in the salt and pepper with savage motions. She ate as much as she could and dumped the rest out while Janice sat staring and pretending not to notice anything.
"Now," said Abel, enjoying himself, "we are going to buy a house. What do you think of the idea?"
"I think it is a good idea," Margaret said.
Janice's hands moved as though they did not belong to her body.
"He will have the law on us. He will have us in court again. Another shame."
Always during their arguments, that thing came up about the law and the court, and whenever Margaret had tried to ask about it, neither of them would tell her. At first, she had thought it must have something to do with Bradley's death because of the police coming, but since it came up in this way again and again in their latest battles over the house, Margaret got the feeling that it was something older and more bitter, a deep trouble, a humiliation. Apparently, it had been Abel's doing, Abel's blame, but Janice had been the one punished for it, because it was always Janice who spoke of it, throwing it as a last weapon, the one to wound most deeply. Now Margaret could see that it had been used once too often. It no longer carried so far or hurt so sharply. Abel only shrugged and told Margaret to call some real estate men and to tell them this. He took a paper out of his pocket on which were the features he wanted in a house and the amount of money he could pay. She looked at the paper and was moved. How long and carefully he must have figured it all. He must have asked many people at work and at church where there were nice sections to live with houses that were modest but well-built, places with lawns and backyards, not too far from church or from the car line to work. The details had all been lovingly assembled, and when Janice looked up again, Margaret took the paper to her to show the care in it.
"Flowers, Mother. Trees. A little garden, maybe."
Janice only sighed and looked away. The next day, on her lunch hour, Margaret called a realtor for whom she had done some extra work. He didn't remember her, but sounded pleased with the exactness of the specifications she gave. Since there were many houses possible, he suggested calling for them at their home and taking them from place to place in his car. She talked him out of meeting them at their home, suggesting that his office would be better. She hung up the phone without allowing herself a smile or a picture for her mind of a house, any house. It was better not to think of how much she wanted a house, a place to belong, a past, even if it were a fiction for her to remember having grown from. Something might happen. It often did.
Maybe they would not be able to agree on a price. Janice would find some other way to wage her battle. Something would happen. So Margaret went back to work and that evening told Abel and Janice the arrangements she had made. She did not mention that there would be a car. Her only worry was that she had not told the realtor her parents were deaf and that he would be doing business through her. The meeting was stiff and somewhat embarrassing. It was a chilly day with a winter rawness in it and a fitful wind that blew in sharp gusts down the Sunday empty business streets. The office had looked closed, but Margaret insisted that they try the door. It was open and the realtor was inside waiting for them in his coat and hat. Margaret introduced them and explained about her parents, giving him a moment to understand but not long enough to worry. As he led them to the car, he said to her,
"I never had anyone like that before. Can they sign contracts? Legally, I mean."
"Oh, yes," she said, and did not add the word of sarcasm that was suddenly in her mind. Janice and Abel had stopped before the car, and the realtor motioned them in, relieved when they understood, and stepped back for him to open the door. Abel noticed a change in his wife's face as they seated themselves in the back. Margaret was up in front with the man whose mouth was going on and on beneath a face that had a set, closed look. But Janice's closeness was gone. She was trying not to show it. Her lips were pulled together and her head was held in the righteous hurt way she used. But Abel saw that she was only imitating herself. Something was changed in her and had touched the subtle lines in her face of which she had no knowledge. He saw it in her cheeks, her chin, her hands, spread a very little as they waited in her lap. Janice was having fun. As secretly as a child hiding his candy, Janice was trying to hide the enjoyment that threatened to break upon her face at any moment. It was the car. "Of course," Abel smiled himself then. In all the arguments, in the ugly words they threw at each other, in the times of begging, in the times of stubborn anger, she had always managed to include that car that he had bought and lost. That car that had been his own selfish, vain need, that chained them in the end to debt and poverty for 20 years and shamed them before the speaking and the deaf. Now she was being driven around like a rich person in the back seat in a fine new car with ashtrays in each armrest and a lap robe in case of cold. Very slowly and secretly, her hand moved down to the thick, scratchy new mohair cloth on the seat, and she began to feel it a little, feeling for the grain of it this way and that, until she found it, and then in a hidden way she began to stroke it in the way a person strokes a cat. A terrifying thought suddenly came to him, and he lifted her hands quickly so that she had to look at him, and then he said,
"You won't do a bad thing. You won't let him take us around all day and say no and no to all the houses just to have a ride."
She pulled her hand away and went back to stroking, with only the thumb now, back and back on the smooth track of the mohair. He could see a pulling at the corners of her mouth, very small, as though she were just about to smile. But Janice was too many years away from playing, and the mouth only pulled downward and her palms turned up. She shrugged one shoulder. "You have the money. You have the choice. You are the one who buys the cars and the ruby rings and takes them away again." Then she set her eyes straight ahead, and her thumb crept back to stroke, stroke over the mohair seat. The first two houses were not right, although they fitted the careful demands that Abel had written. There was some mysterious lack in them and in the neighborhoods, and he was unhappy because he was not able, even in sign to Margaret, to explain his dislike. He was also afraid of the realtor's displeasure, but to his surprise, the man was not angry or even annoyed. He gave Margaret some facts, which she told them about the heating or the foundations, the roof, the water. But when Abel showed his disinterest, the man stopped what he was saying and took them right back to the car. The third house was a little better, and they tried dutifully as he suggested to see themselves living in it with familiar furniture here and there, or as they hoped to furnish it later, with nice things. Still, it wasn't right,
and the realtor could see them beginning to tire with the effort of giving their imaginations into the rooms and the yard and the corners.
"Your folks are getting a little tired," he said to the girl. "They aren't used to this kind of thing, up and down steps, in and out. It tires some people out quick."
"No,"
she said, but then was unable to say more. Coming stolidly behind, Abel and Janice walked with heads ringing. They ached with the effort of filling rooms with invisible furniture, seeing and unseeing, making and unmaking the invisible lives of their invisible wish selves. The realtor looked at Margaret to explain, and when she didn't, shrugged and looked at the next house on his list. Many people had house dreaming as a Sunday recreation, and he had to make sure that no one just did the rounds without the intention of buying. He suggested they stop for lunch and then continue down the list. The relief on their faces was evident without the easing sign. They got into the car and Margaret said to him,
"I hope you won't take us to a big place, I mean fancy."
She paused and added,
"It embarrasses them."
He looked at her and answered pleasantly,
"Okay."
He smiled when he said it, and the look and smile seemed too frank to her, as though he were judging her in some way. Where does she fit in? What's in this for her? She turned away, only to feel Janice's forefinger poking her shoulder, an annoying reminder that Janice used when she felt left out of something and wanted the words of it.
"I told him to pick a little place because we didn't want anything expensive to eat. He said he would. I don't know where we will get the money for all this. Buying houses, eating out, riding around in cars. You said this can take weeks and weeks before we find a place. And all that time, lunch is out, maybe dinners too. It all costs money. All of it." She sat back, vindicated.
"I had a grandmother who was hard of hearing," the realtor said. "She had one of those black ear trumpets, you know, and I'd have to go up close and yell into it for her to hear me. But you could open up the cupboard door way in the next room and she'd call out, 'Get me a piece of that candied fruit you're taking.'"
He laughed a short, sudden laugh, and then turned quickly to accept Margaret's laughter, and when he saw there was none, that her face had not changed, said,
"No offense meant. Your folks back there just reminded me of her, that's all. My granny, she used to poke me all the time, just like your mother there, to try to get me to tell her what everyone was saying."
He shook his head.
"She was a dilly, though, my granny. Died last spring."
"Oh," Margaret said. "That's too bad."
"Well, I think she really wanted to go. She was way up in the years, and at the end there, she was deaf as a post. I really think she was glad to go."
He chuckled a little and shook his head, his hands and feet working smoothly at the mechanisms of the car. Janice and Abel, sitting in the back, had begun to speak in a very small language, brief, impersonal, public thoughts. Both were amazed at the ease and grace with which the realtor drove his car. It humbled them that speaking could have the kind of closeness with their machines that deaf did. Janice did not need seam guides, but could see a seam straight, could feed to and from that making seem naturally in any rhythm of her machine's own speed. Abel could feel faults in the press even before the printed sheets came through. And the man in front of them knew to drive without looking, to move the stick and wheel and to push the pedals without conscious thought to do so and without looking at his hands or feet. Often he would not be looking at the road at all, but into the little mirror put up over the front window to provide communion with those in the back. Considerately, they moved closer together and into his angle of vision so that he might be able to see both of them at the same time. They stopped for sandwiches and coffee at a strange place with a long name. Deli, 12 letters and somewhere. The food was foreign and unfamiliar, but it was very good, filling and not too expensive. They were refreshed when they started again. The realtor, feeling more comfortable, ventured a joke, which Margaret signed small to them. He was halfway through when he realized it was a play on words and that the signs might not render it. He struggled on to the end and they all laughed anyway. As they got into the car, he caught a glimpse of Margaret trying to explain it to them. While they were at lunch, the sun had come and had taken possession. They walked into noon brightness, which wind had cleaned to an autumnal purity. Of course, the trees were bare.
It was already December, but the smells, the flavor of the air, were the smells and flavors of late last harvests.
It doesn't feel like winter at all, the realtor said. It's real football weather.
Oh?
Sure is. Say, I was going to listen to the game today. The Giants are playing Brooklyn.
Baseball, but I thought...
Football. The football teams. I thought maybe the game might get called on account of snow, but look at it now. Great. Just great.
They got into the car again. The realtor's face was the business face again.
I'm going to another part of town, an older neighborhood. I have a nice one there. The houses aren't as new, but they're built well and they have more ground with them. The house I'm going to show you is a real little honey.
Margaret told her parents and they nodded, and the car went its smooth, instinctive way over and across and through street after street, turning right, left, north, east, until Margaret's head spun. They had come around, though in a wide half-circle, and she recognized some of the streets as being not far from Vandalia. Only now they were south of where Vandalia began in its filthy, boxed-in end of river and railroad yards, and where the city folded over and crowded in upon itself. As they rode on, Abel's fingers began to move in faint, half-formed sign. He was murmuring to himself, "This is that place. That summer place, this is the old one, the old number one where... This is the summer." "What are you saying?" Janice poked his arm in irritation. Abel didn't know it, but sometimes he signed in his sleep, and when he was dreaming, he often had the bits and ends of words in his hands. There was something about these vaguely waving gestures, spoken without mind or presence, that were terrifying to Janice. She also remembered the school lectures on self-abuse and its badness, and groped at the ideas behind the flap-flap minister's mouth, words written on the board to make sure that everyone understood. Fingering oneself, play with private parts. The school people said that fingering to oneself was dirty, and playing with the secret parts was a sign of madness. Wasn't it so that insane people always gesture and make wild signs? Their fingers picking and seeing here and there, moving not of their owner's moving will. Abel must know how much she hated that muttering of his. He was only doing it to annoy her.
"What is it?" she insisted. "What are you talking about?"
I was only remembering that we used to live near here and we walked near here sometimes, on Sundays, in the summer.
"I remember," she said. And her face moved toward sorrow. "We couldn't afford anything else but walking."
"But don't you remember how happy—" And he stopped, because it was silly to try to tell someone of her own past happiness. Janice had changed, and in changing had made over all the memories behind her. He felt lonely suddenly, and when they passed the place where they once lived and where Margaret had been born, he did not look at his wife or touch his daughter to show her where it was. He sat back and said nothing. They went then into a neighborhood of generous houses, where huge trees touched branches over the street. Hedges, arbors, and shrubbery waited in the fine-boned fragility of their dormancy, and brown lawns spread in the laps of the houses. Toward the middle of the block, the car slowed down and then pulled to a stop along the curb. The house was quite a bit smaller than the others on the block. It looked as though it might once have been part of the house that stood to the right of it, a house for some married relative whose needs were simpler. The house was white and square, but with bow windows on both floors, and a small porch on which one could sit in the summer and look out over the neat front lawn to the great trees. They went up the walk with the solemn, self-conscious caution of visitors in a hospital. At the bottom of the steps, Abel touched the tips of one of the naked hedges, his face rapt and silent. The realtor began to explain some of the features of the house, and Margaret translated quickly, almost clinically. No word was said nor questions asked. With the docility of sleepwalkers, they allowed themselves to be led up the stairs and inside.
"It is an older house," the realtor was saying, so as to give them no cause to complain when they came to themselves. "It needs repairs. Until you get the roof insulated a little better, you are going to have to pay a pretty heavy heating bill, and some of the plumbing is a bit old and leaky."
They went from room to room, the realtor almost pulling them on as he noted and pointed out the necessary details.
When they had been shown the upstairs and the attic and the kitchen and backyard, they came into the parlor again and stood in the middle of the dusty, empty room, whose floor was streaked and squared with branch-hatched sunlight. Margaret watched her parents standing there motionlessly, so close to each other that their clothing touched. They looked old and fragile, and lost in all the empty space of the room. The realtor bustled forward and raised and lowered the window several times to show them how easily they worked. The sight of his car at the curb seemed to give him a sudden idea.
"Say," and he turned to Margaret, "would your folks mind if I hopped out to the car for a minute? I want to get the score on that game."
She said it would be all right because she wanted to speak to her parents quickly before he came back. They had been too awed and unquestioning, too deeply found, too homed. There were faults in the house, questions to be answered. The realtor might make the price high because he had seen what she had seen, how homed they were, how numbed at the miracle of it.
"Well, you just look around," he said. "Anything you want to know."
He waved a bit and the door closed, and Margaret saw him through the window going down the walk. Janice and Abel came to themselves in a panic.
"What is wrong? Why is he leaving?"
Margaret comforted them and was about to go into the problems of the house when she noticed that the realtor was behaving in a strange way. He had opened the passenger door and left it open while he sat inside to listen. Then he had gotten out of the car, leaving the door still open, and he was standing on the sidewalk, his head turning right and left, as though watching for someone with great urgency. His hands were moving slightly, his eyes looked blank, and his face was dazed. In a slow, dreamlike rhythm, he began to walk back up to the house, bumping against the front gate, which he did not seem to see. Behind him, the car gaped. Margaret found herself coldly alert, fearing. She moved between the dreamers and the door through which the man, frightened or angry or suffering some kind of madness, might come. She heard the door open and then saw him. He was ill. His face was strange and very pale. He gestured weakly toward the outside, the car.
"On the radio," he said, "breaking in on the game."
Janice and Abel had turned and were staring at him, and Margaret felt the familiar jab.
They said the Japanese just bombed Pearl Harbor.
"Where is that?"
Margaret said, and moved out of Janice's reach.
"Hawaii, I think. I think it's in Hawaii."
"But that can't be. It must be some kind of joke. The Japanese?"
She tried to laugh. It was as fantastic as Finland or Paraguay declaring war.
"Come on out and listen," he said.
So they went together, and when they came back to the house, Margaret told her parents, who were still standing in the floating dust-mote sunshine of the dreaming room,
"The Japanese have made explosions from airplanes in Hawaii."
Their faces were open, interested.
"Why?" Abel asked. "Did the airplanes crash?"
"They have made these explosions to start a war."
"Mistake, bad and wrong," Janice said. "We must tell them that we do not want it." They turned back toward the window, and then Janice motioned to the wall where a sofa must be and a small table, with flowers or ivy growing, just the way it was at the minister's house. Two or three times they asked Margaret about the necessity for a rug, but she seemed suddenly to have lost her interest in the house. She and the realtor were just standing there, staring at each other. Then, without a word, they both went back to the car and sat in it, listening and listening to that blind, invisible mouth. 14. At first, it was difficult to understand how the bombing of a place that was not even in America was war. But through the week, everyone came to the minister's house seeking information because of the strange new times. Everyone needed the reassurance of friends. One could tell by the day he came how much contact a person had with the hearing speaking. The minister had it all to explain over and over. Janice and Abel had been among the first to know, but they were not the first to believe. and after the words had been given and taken, they drew together and waited for the armies of invasion.
"Everyone will hear the shooting and the bombs," Janice cried wildly to Margaret. "Everyone will run away and be safe. You will be at work, and how will we know where to go and what people to trust?"
Abel, standing in the light, was losing his words in its glare. When he saw that he couldn't be understood, he moved away, momentarily annoyed that it took so much work to try to comfort Janice.
"Margaret will tell us. She will know."
"She will leave," Janice attacked. "She gets letters from that army place from a man there. She will leave us alone in the war when the soldiers come."
The days passed, and Janice and Abel scented the air and watched into the sun for signs and then scuttled off to work, and when the day was over came straight home, not daring to stop for the eggs or the cigarettes, lest they be caught unguarded and defenseless in the streets. Had they not seen Margaret going to work each day, they would have stayed away themselves, the door barricaded, the carving knife sharp and ready on the kitchen table. But the days went by. Days that were full of changes, fears, and frantic rumors. And yet the war did not come, and the country was not invaded. After some weeks, Janice and Abel began to grow puzzled about this war where there was no fighting on their streets. Margaret tried to convince them that they should go ahead and buy the house as they had planned. They argued and stalled a dozen times, having pictured it destroyed, bombed, burned, looted. Margaret kept calling, putting off the realtor and trying to get him to wait. Since Margaret had met William Anglin at the office and had seen him off to the army, she had been corresponding with him regularly. Janice raised her eyebrows when she handed his letters to Margaret, but she didn't know how to ask about the man behind the precise, closely written numbers on the envelope. William wrote from camp that confusion and rumor were the main products of the war so far. Thousands of men were pouring into camps that were unready and unsupplied. The weapons on which they trained were broken and outdated. They had to be passed from man to man and then demonstrated before the group. Men might go into battle, he said, without actually having fired the guns they would hopefully be given. They sighted down wooden weapons and practiced the slow squeeze on a rigid wooden trigger. The only thing plentiful was gossip, and a slow, equalizing fear. He wrote again that they might soon be going overseas and that he expected to get home again before leaving. If it was possible, he would come. The trains were overcrowded, the buses impossible. He would do everything he could. He signed the letter, "All my love." There seemed to be a frantic and fevered quality to the days. People hurried, work doubled. Any action was better than none. The greetings that Abel exchanged yearly with his parents did not include the usual message, "We are all well." There did not seem to be time to say such things. The excitement burned against the winter and made the spring pass dizzily as if from too much breathing. There were air raid drills and blackout drills. Janice objected to the special curtains that had to be fitted to the windows to keep in all the light. At church, Abel heard about plans for rationing, and there were rumors of people hoarding the foods that would soon be rare. The people spoke recklessly, their sign too big, too loud. Even the reserved and comfortable people, the rich, well-educated few, the leaders among the deaf, spoke with a nervous haste, part patriotism and part fear, that raced in the eyes, hands, faces, bodies. Nothing seemed normal. The streets were suddenly full of men in uniform, and there were girls with them, very hard-faced, open-mouthed girls, Janice said, and they came walking four abreast, filling the sidewalk and letting no one by. A person had to step off into the street, and she nodded slowly with a grave pinch mouth. As the months went on, Margaret also noticed a hardness in the laughter of the sailors and the girls, out late at night looking for something to do along the avenue. Some of the hard laughter was the giddiness of exhaustion. Many of her friends were working on two jobs, a daytime job and a late shift at one of the defense plants that had sprung up on the other side of the railroad yards. Suddenly, there was work everywhere. Amalia Cibelli's father, who had been too poor to dye last year, went to work and got himself a set of dentures, and Amalia dyed her hair red and had it permanent waved.
In June, Janice came home, her fingers wide and stuttering with pride, and told them that she had been made section supervisor. Her pay was doubled, and she had learned to understand time and a half. The mill now was making fatigue hats and jackets for the army, and a man, some kind of government foreman, she thought, had come to her machine and stopped and watched her for a long time, and then went away nodding. And now she was going to be section supervisor, and her way of end begin without stopping the machine was going to become the way, the factory standard. Even in Janice and Abel, there was some of the wild restlessness of hearing in those times. An unease in which wild elation was as common as terror and grief. Janice's first day in her new position was a blend of fear and pride, kept to such point closeness that she thought she might be going insane. Always in the past, her accurate, fast methods had been thought too dangerous, and her skill was feared by the other girls on the floor. Now it was all changed. The union people didn't pick on her, and the girls at the machines looked on in awe as she demonstrated for the new ones. She began by sitting down with slow, forbidding dignity, her deafness and silence thundering in the minds of the watching girls. No charm would put her off, no excuses would do, no promises would reach her. Then she leaned forward, the machine started, the cloth began to flow, and there came that steady, magical growing of quantities of finished work on the side table. She could see, looking without seeming to, the awe on their faces, sometimes the fear. Many of the girls who went back to try her way at their own machines had fingers chewed under the needles, but now there was no sympathy for them, only impatience because they had been inattentive. Abel was also beginning to find himself rediscovered at his work. A few of the young men had left immediately for the army and their places were not filled. Suddenly, orders had begun to pour in from everywhere. There were instructional leaflets for new and part-time employees, posters, signs, and booklets to urge, explain, and teach quickly those leaving and those staying, all in new and urgent language. Everyone was trying to get the attention of people dizzied with change. The shop was drowning in a pour of printed words when news came, first by rumor and then from the government that paper would soon be in short supply and would eventually be placed on the list of war commodities and rationed. There were frantic rules and frantic changes of the rules for other rules, and Abel, his fears now less than his fellows, only different, worked on in his own long rhythm. The months went on, and the idea of America's having been attacked was replaced by a belief that the attack was a fluke, and that a few months would see it all avenged. This belief died in the fall of more islands and cities, and soon, only the realities of supply, need, production, and tactic remained. When a machine broke down, there would be no replacement parts. It was as simple as that. Abel knew that the men in the shop thought he had the power of hearing his press. He also knew fleetingly and ambiguously, far below words, that his deafness and the isolation it forced on him made his coworkers see in him a strange kind of strength, a spirituality and virtue, as though his silence, ear and mouth, made him a mystical communicant with things deeper in the world than speech, than people. Now, when nothing broken could be fixed, it became important for them that there be magic. Abel did partly hear his machine. Its vibrations sang up through the floor, through his shoes and into his bones. The note had a steadiness like a heartbeat, divided into stronger and weaker pulses, different in weight but the same in tone. Over the years, he had learned many of the signs of wear or carelessness that could be shown by differences in the weight or constancy of these vibrations. He had learned to detect other things by putting his fingers or his palms on the machine and letting the vibrations sound through his hands. He had, a few times, suddenly stopped his press and begun to take it down, and always a worn bearing had been found, or some part beginning to loosen, or friction that oil had not eased. Now, with the war shortages making a burnt-out motor or frozen roller bearings a catastrophe, Abel also found himself a kind of talisman presence in the shop. And other men often came to ask him to come, please, and listen to their machines. Sometimes the trouble was to be seen immediately, overheating, sticking, even smoke. How gravely they would watch as he touched for the humming tone or, in a press like his own, the double beat. They watched as though he were a kind of priest. Margaret had kept fighting them in their success bemusement to make up their minds about the house. In the first weeks of fear, they had told her to call up the realtor and cancel their plans. Margaret had called him, but begged for time. She had kept on begging for time, which the realtor said he would give until another buyer came along. There were rumors that all wages and prices would soon be frozen, and speculators were buying up what they could before the markets froze. Scarcity would soon make any house unavailable. With her usual unwavering persistence, Margaret worked on at Janice and Abel about the house. Her reasons, the deepest ones, were kept from them, and they never seemed to suspect a connection in her motives between the need for a house and her growing correspondence with William. They merely shrugged after a comment or two about the letters that she was getting from different places. To Margaret herself, there were many parts to the single reason of William. She and William had been writing steadily to each other, and from camp to camp, their native reserve and caution had yielded to the overwhelming force of loneliness. Their letters had become longer and more self-revealing. They kept the tone of them general, as careful people would. Conditions at the camps and at home, descriptions of places and people, but she was able to read need and fear as well as pleasure in his unveiling of a dry humor. It was almost deaf humor. Not wit that enjoyed plays on words or surprising ideas, but a humor that came from observation and connection.
"The CO's tie does not show beneath his collar and back, and his belt is not notched so tightly. I think his wife must be home from Cleveland. The sergeant asked us where we went on pass, and no one would say the library, even though that's the only place besides the churches that the town leaves open to us. The younger men make things up, and the older ones say they hung around or went here and there. Here and there is never the library. I saw 8 or 9 soldiers each time I was there. We are not deeply loved in the town."
In March, he had been made a lieutenant and was transferred, and she sent him a small sewing kit with which to sew on successive stripes, bars, and badges. He sent back a picture of himself standing in front of the barracks, and when he came home on leave before going overseas, she had dinner twice with his family, the second time with aunts and a sister, and the formal, fearful hollowness in the air that marked the occasion as serious. It was too soon, too far in too short a time. She felt she had had no chance to tell William about Janice and Abel, or to do anything more than give a lame excuse to his family when no invitation from them was forthcoming after William went back to camp. That was when she had begun to nag them about getting the house. The letters stopped. There had been one from Seattle and then nothing, and William's mother had called Margaret twice at work to ask if there was any news. They had lunch together one day, and noticed in the careful, subtle measuring they did that they were very much alike in temperament. Time was getting short. In her next letter, Margaret decided she would have to tell William why she had never let him take her home, and why her parents had not invited him to dinner. If only they would move away from Vandalia Street now. If only they could do it before William and his family would be forced to visit. In that lovely and quiet, tree-lined, movie American neighborhood, Janice and Abel's deafness would seem less like part of an overwhelming difference. They could seem like the other people of the street, dignified and capable. It was almost impossible to write simple facts. While she waited for the words to arrange themselves in her mind, she brooded over William's few moments of confusion when during the furlough she had made excuses and not let him see her home. It had happened many times and she had used many excuses. It was too far. It was too late. He was tired. But the reasons had sounded false and had left him with a look of puzzled disappointment. Now, every day that she went home, she saw the street as if for the first time, as though through William's eyes. It was noisy, crowded, shouting, raucous, but a deaf street all the same. How could she have grown up in such a strange, uncomprehending deaf street? How could she still live there? Still with the mysterious parents whom he had never seen. This new vision of the street was sudden, complete, and appalling. She had been to his house and had come back home still bathed in its gentility and quiet order. His house, all the houses on his street, lay in the same decorous drawn-curtain stillness. Vandalia was like a canyon from which the walls rose overhead, hollowed with a thousand caves and pockets, all sprouting the unmade heads of frowsy women, gap-mouthed and bawling. The pushcart criers and children in the gutter screamed back at them. The sidewalks were heaped with refuse. Obscenity covered the walls of the buildings, and from every alley and side window, bank on bank, the wash lines lifted, flapping. Ragged scarecrows of the week's wearings. It was everyone's private history, day and night, size and condition, blown lewdly over full by the wind. As she walked closer to her own doorway, the vision was sharpened in spite of a shame so great that she had to stop sometimes, afraid of being sick on the street. There was the pawn shop, and no memories of safety or sanctuary or learning or affection could save it from the relentless judgment of the new eyes, William's eyes. She began to wonder how many times she had brushed by the pale, trembling, hopeless ghosts that were always coming or going through their shared front door. Customers. Here they would stand for a moment out of the wind, stinking of coal oil, sweat, urine, vomit, and bad whiskey, trying to remember how to make themselves invisible again. They came to pawn things or to wait in the little vestibule, and sometimes Mr. Petrakis would find them sleeping there and would have to wake them up and send them away. Did the years of those old men and their failures hang on her? Only in a strange way, disembodied and removed, could Margaret remember how she had once seen the dusty mandolins and trays of junk as priceless and exotic treasures, tests of every ounce of strength she had not to touch and fondle them in wonder. And Mr. Petrakis himself, a loud, gesticulating old man in sour, dirty clothing, dealing in all the ugliness and failure of the street. Even the little on the street that shone and was heroic was cheapened in the end and came to him. She had seen on the second shelf of the cabinet under the cash register a small tray of medals. On any other street, in any other place, such things would have been family treasures, kept reverently under the pictures of honored dead. Not on Vandalia Street. Past the pawn shop door were the stairs that led up to her home. William, loving or not, would notice how the hall stank and that the stairs were dark, and that a hand on the railing would come away greasy or sticky. If she could get her father and mother out of the bemused days of their success and into the new house in time, she might be able to pretend to herself that they had always lived there, and they could entertain. Her next letter to William was written and rewritten until the casual mention of her parents' deafness and the explanation for her odd behavior sounded stiff and artificial. His answer a month later from an unnamed place in the Pacific was gentle and puzzled. He didn't see why she had kept this from him. Had they been blind, crippled in some way, it would have been easier to understand. Blindness is so total a thing, she might have been afraid of his pity. But with the stupidities being let loose,